And now I would like to introduce our main speaker for this evening, Jeff T. from La Mesa.
My name is Jeff Thorsness. I'm an alcoholic. It's good to be in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's good to be sober. And I want to thank Randy for extending the privilege to speak in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's always a privilege, and it's always an honor to do anything in Alcoholics Anonymous. So I feel truly blessed to be here. There's so many people here that came tonight, and our friends Tim and Leslie drove down from Santa Ana, and they actually met at our house, and we lived in Pacifica, and we had a little secret plan, Anita and I. We had them over for Thanksgiving, and they walked their dog and came back, and they've been a couple ever since, and you know. And I love Alcoholics Anonymous, and Maury, you did a fantastic job. And Anita and John raised the bar last week. I mean, if you weren't here, my wife spoke last week, Anita, and I absolutely love her. And I love our commitment to Alcoholics Anonymous. It's the reason why we are. You know, we met in the world-famous Lemon Grove Alano Club. And that was the last time we went to the Alano Club. I swooped her out of there. No, I'm kidding. You know, it's good to be anywhere, really. I'll get into that in a minute. And our grandkids are here, too, tonight. We have our little granddaughters running around with a little angel, the wings on. Has anybody seen her or the lights? And, you know, she's running around. My grandson is going to join us in a few minutes here. You know, I guess I suppose I should tell you, I used to drink. I think it's incumbent of us to talk about drinking, you know. This is Alcoholics Anonymous, right? You know, if I just told you how good my life was without telling you that I used to drink like a pig, and then you wouldn't know, you know. And we have five new people here, and I'd like to welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous. And if my experience means anything, is you don't have to suffer the pain of early sobriety again. You know, this can be it for you. This can be it, man. Join the herd. Join the tribe. You know, I used to drink, and I found the solution for me, as Maura talked about, at a very early age, and was drinking cheap red wine with my buddies, you know. And I instantly fell in love with the way cheap red wine made me feel. But I started getting in trouble, and I didn't really get in too much trouble till the eighth grade, and then the wheels started coming off at an early age. You know, I didn't know I had an abnormal reaction to alcohol. I mean, to me, it was amazing. It was kind of like putting two forks in the socket, you know. When, you know, it's kind of like, oh, man, this is good, you know. I just, you know, the sense of ease and comfort that comes at drinking cheap red wine. You know, I was just astonished at an early age. And I was cute. I was a cute little kid. And I just knew I couldn't go to, I know, it's not too hard to imagine. But, you know, I went to my parents. And I just knew I couldn't go to my parents and say, you know, I've just found the solution for the way I feel. It seems to be drinking cheap red wine with the little juvenile delinquents that I hang around with. I just knew my parents weren't going to buy that. So I began the sneak around phase. You know, I think we all go through the sneak around phase. And shortly thereafter, my dad started putting like locks on the liquor cabinet, you know, but all you got to do is have tools and you figure out how to get in there and do that. So I would drink anything. And the first time that I was to hear the words Alcoholics Anonymous was 1968. Yeah, baby. And I was a freshman in high school, and me and my buddies got together and we chugged a quart of Jim Beam. And I saw some J.D. East aftershave lotion, and I thought, well, a few pops of J.D. East will kind of be the capper. So sure enough, I hit a little of the aftershave lotion, and boy, I'll tell you, I haven't had aftershave lotion ever since then. Immediately cured of that. But I got violently sick, and we walked to the high school football game right over there by Helix High School. And summarily got, you know, expelled from Helix for 6 months, and that 6 months is the longest point of sobriety that I've had, except for the time I've been in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I just, you know, I thought it was a good idea. I don't drink, but you know, the night I got reenlisted back in high school, me and my buddies got together one more time, and they were still drinking rot gut. You know, they were drinking 192 and 151 and all that. And I did what it talks about in Chapter 3. In fact, somebody read Chapter 3 tonight, Bill. I did the experiments. You know, we all kind of change our environment. We change our combinations. We change it. And I changed to natural wines and brandy and things like that. some unnatural wines. I'm not sure Pink and Pink Ripple has anything. Does that have grapes in it or not? I don't know. We're still wondering if that has grapes. But I tell you, it had the effect. I just love the effect produced by alcohol. So I got married at a... Well, I started getting trouble in high school, a lot of trouble and stuff. And I found a gal, and we were eventually to become married. And what I was really doing through that, I mean, there was some love there, but I was really just trying to escape. You know, I thought, I've always hung around with, like, older people, you know what I mean? Got to have somebody old enough to buy or hang around with more mature people, somehow thinking that if I hung out with mature people, I, in turn, would become mature. That wasn't my experience. I was just hanging out with older people. But, you know, I hooked up with this little gal, and we started dating in high school and so on and so forth. And next, her father-in-law was a plastering contractor. So what happened for me was I just quit going to school. And I went to work for her father-in-law as a hod carrier. And we have any hod carriers in there here? Yeah, right. We got a hottie in here. A lot of ex-hod carriers, I'm sure. But it was hard work, you know. And I just loved the way that the guys drank. You know, we would drink just about anything. Of course, it was a very physical job, and so I got married at a young age, and you know, had envisioned someday owning his plastering company. The problem with that is I don't like to show up like 5 consecutive days to go to work. I think that's just unrealistic. You know, it's just you know, you usually take like Wednesday because we have a poker party on Wednesday night, and I just get these crushing, brutal hangovers. So getting up and going to work on Thursday is not a good idea. However, Friday, you're there for the paycheck. And so, you know, I discovered somewhere along the line, I started to realize that I had some kind of an abnormal reaction to alcohol, particularly when I gave up the hard liquor and I started drinking beer, because I could drink a 12-pack of beer. And then next thing you know, I would get a case of beer. Now, there's something abnormal to drinking a case of beer. They really try to drink a 6-pack of water. You can't do it. I assure you. If you can chug 4 bottles of water, I'll buy you a case. You know, you just, so something, the effect alcohol has when it hits our system, if you're alcoholic, is abnormal. So it immediately sets up, and Dr. Silkworth observed thousands of alcoholics, and he observed thousands of people the way we drink. And in his observation, he says, well, men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. Well, I love the effect produced by alcohol. I mean, any alcoholic in here, I mean, we develop an intimate love affair with the effect produced by alcohol. Then he goes on to say that there's some kind of an abnormal reaction, this physical allergy, that once we ingest alcohol into our system, I don't seem to be able to shut it off. And to me, like Mara was talking about, the next drink just sounds like a good idea. You know, the next one, I'll take one, and then the next one's like, well, it's... One, I'm just overreacting to this alcohol thing. I think I'll have another one in a case and so on and so forth. I didn't know till I came to Alcoholics Anonymous that that was a physical allergy, that once I took a can of beer, I immediately craved another one and another one. And when the beer's gone, we're going for scotch. And I tried to be a scotch drinker for 6 months, and vodka's a lot easier, you know, and... Scotch is some nasty stuff, but I tried, you know. So I've always had this abnormal reaction to alcohol, and, you know, I married this gal at a young age, and we kind of worked into this marriage, and, you know, I started doing the things that young alcoholic men do. You know, I became a liar, cheat, and a thief through that relationship. And I would do anything or say anything. I would just make stuff up, you know. I'm the kind of guy that goes out for a pack of cigarettes and I don't come home for 2 or 3 days. You know, and guess what? They miss you. They know you're not there. And you can only create so many different scenarios of running into old friends and, you know, losing your keys and... And I'm a blackout drinker. I'm sure we got some blackout drinkers in here. You know, alcohol-induced amnesia. I didn't know that till I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I just thought I would get magically transported from La Mesa to Ocean Beach. And just like all of a sudden you wake up and you're across town, you know. Or you wake up and you're in Tijuana. You know, that's a culture shock right there. It's Sunday night. Tijuana sounded like a good idea at some point in time. So this is not going well. when I was growing up, drink trouble, drink trouble, drink trouble. And so what happened for me, you know, along the way, just a lot of little things, much like Maura talked about, was that my daughter Sarah was born, and I said I was going to be the wonderful father. I was going to be a good provider. I was going to do all the things that fathers should do. And, you know, I want to be that guy, you know. And but this alcoholism, selfishness, and the self-centeredness, and the lying, and the cheating, and the stealing, and the whole thing, my wife lost her sense of humor somewhere along the line there. And in a big way, she lost it. So some things started to happen, and the notion of not seeing my daughter on a regular basis was too much for me to bear. So, you know, I did one of those things, the little, you know, I'll take my life thing. And what happened was I got a handful of Valium and some booze, and I ate all the Valium, and I drank it down with a bottle of whiskey, and I crawled up on the roof to die. On the way up, I called my parents to thank them for being my parents, number one, but I have to die, you know, one of these deals. A little bit of martyrdom, I suppose. And that's before they had helicopters and stuff. And so I'm up on the roof, and it's a parapet roof, and I'm hiding on there, and the cops are running around the house with flashlights. And, you know, I'm, screw you, you're not going to take me. And then my mother had a nickname for me, and my mother and father showed up, and my mother walked around the house. My nickname's Taffy. And because I know... What's so funny about that? I had white hair growing up. Jeez. One little family secret, and you just tee off on that. So my mother walked around the house going, Taffy, Taffy. And I fell off the roof, and they pumped my stomach. And I hope you guys, this is an anonymity thing, right? And, you know, I have two older brothers and a younger sister, and they're not alcoholics. They're not alcoholics. I've seen them drink, and it's almost embarrassing. You know, they'll you know, open a glass of wine. They'll get, like, at dinner, they'll, like, order separate glasses of different wines instead of the bottle, and then the glass will just sit there, you know, and they'll sip a little. And I'm just not that guy, you know. And about halfway through, sober, I looked at him. I said, you know, I hang out with people that wouldn't even touch the back of their throat. They just throw that stuff down. Drink the wine. And but they don't have the reaction that we seem to have to alcohol. But my oldest brother was a very successful attorney. And my other brother, I mean, they're just painted with success. You know, I'm the black sheep of the family. I don't know how people get up and go to work every day and work for a paycheck, and they're kind and respectful to people, and they bring the paycheck home and spend it on bills and pay the bills. I mean, all that stuff just seems so lame. I mean, really. And I mean, because I'm, like, out on the edge, always experiencing the edge of life, man. You know, I'm the guy, like, standing on the precipice, man. I want to feel it, you know. And if I'm going down, baby, I'm going down in flames. You know, that's been my entire life. And I don't need no fishing license. I don't need no driver's license. I don't, you know, I'm living out there on the fat of the land, man. And But my brother is a very successful attorney, and I mean, he just seems to roll into money. I mean, you know, and he's friends with presidents and governors, and, you know, he bought radio stations, and, you know, I'm just hanging out with him hoping he drops his wallet somewhere. And you know, really, that's what I want. I want in the wallet, you know, and he kind of took me on as a little, you know, little care package. You know, I'm going to take care of my little brother. I'm going to give him opportunity of a lifetime. So I was out riding horses with him in Wickenburg, Arizona one day, and the magic words came out. He said, you know, Jeff, we just bought some radio stations, and, you know, how'd you like to get into the radio business? And I said, I'd love to get into the radio business. You know, this is the opportunity of a lifetime. I mean, for a guy like me that just can't seem to get it, you know, and my brother's there. He's the guy, you know, and I'm going to be hanging out with these people. Well, of course, I'm going to need a wardrobe and a new car, and all, you know, and I don't have any money at all. So things are starting to look pretty good. And when I show up here, I'm actually working with professional radio people. I mean, these people have degrees in communication. They have degrees in sales and marketing and all this stuff. And I'm like the brother of, you know, one of the guys. And I'm fresh out of the trades. You know, I don't know how to act in an office. I don't know how to be kind or generous to people. I'm just like, you know, give me my stuff. I got to go, you know. And So somehow I had this deep sense that it wasn't going to be okay. You know, but this is the shot of the lifetime, and I go up and, you know, my daughter's praying for me and my parents are praying for me and friends are just going, God, go after it, get it, you know, do it, you know, and this transition of a lifetime. So I show up down here to sell Yuma, down to radio to sell in Yuma to sell advertising for this little radio station. Now, you wouldn't think of Yuma as being a big radio market. Well, it isn't. And I'm about halfway into this, a couple of weeks into this, and I figured, hell, I don't even have enough money to pay my bills. I mean, this is, you know, this radio sales thing. I'm having fun, though. I'm going out in three-piece suits, and I'm selling advertising to these people. And, you know, I envision myself being Junior Chamber of Commerce Guy of the Year and, all this stuff going on in my head. And what happens at night is that, you know, I go out and I party with the bikers, you know. And I start to feel this sense of inferiority, and I'm feeling a little insecure, but I can't go to the biker bar and tell these guys about this. I mean, these guys are tough, you know. And so I begin to cave in on this whole thing, and somehow I know it's not going to be okay. Somehow I know that things aren't going to work out well. So as I'm selling this, you know, I sold the largest electronic media advertising campaign ever in Yuma, which isn't a hell of a lot anyhow. I guess in Yuma I was a big shot, but some things started to happen there, and they do these remotes, and there was a disc jockey, and they pay the disc jockey $100 for 3 hours' work. And I'm thinking, this is what I need to do. I need to get a little of that kind of money, because that's the kind of guy I am. I got a role like that, you know what I mean? And so they talked about having a mascot come out. And so they bought a mascot for the radio station. And it was a 7-foot-tall roadrunner. And, you know, it's like a professional, like the KGB chicken kind of guy. And I grew up watching him. I'm thinking, I can do that. You know, $100 for 3 hours, piece of cake. You know, I can do that. So, you know, I volunteered to do that. Now, it was wintertime when I did that. And it started to warm up in Yuma, you know, come springtime, you know, and this thing is like fake fur, and it's 7 feet tall, and it's buggy feet, and it's nylons, pants, and it's like 130 degrees in that thing. And they want me to go out and hug these little kids for 2 or 3 hours, and these kids are crawling all over you for you. And then I find out that they're not going to pay me anything. So I'm a mascot with a resentment. I'll tell you, I am... With an alcoholic, you know, I like to drink alcoholically. So I'm really pissed off. And once you're in there, you're like the guy, the go-to guy, right? They don't call anybody else. It's like, Scooter, come on, you know. So I drink a 6-pack or 12-pack of beer, and I'd go hug these little bastards, you know. And I'd be moonwalking out in the middle of the street, and, you know, I'm absolutely crazy, man. So... Parents, you may, you know, before you let your kids go play with the mascot, you may consider this story, because I shouldn't have been with the little kids. So some things started to happen, and, you know, it was just absolutely crazy. And I'm having some fun, but I'm absolutely insane. And, you know, there was the last thing about the mascot, there was the celebrity buffalo ride when I actually got on a, you know, a 900-pound buffalo. And it... Apparently, they don't like roadrunners. I tell you, 7 foot tall, yellow, orange. I mean, it was about 2.5 seconds of pure hell getting off of that thing, but enough said. So I went in one day to the radio station, and I, you know, when I moved down there, I was living on a golf course. And 6 months later, I'm living in a little trailer in between lettuce fields. And you know, I'm dating my landlord, so I'm not really paying rent. I'm just dating my landlord and eating out of cans and, you know, steaming my clothes and going to work. And I go in one day, and there's some people from a treatment center in the radio station. And they gave me the account. So as an account executive, it's my job to sit out and find out about your business so I can write these commercials so we can put you on the air. So I sat down with these people. I said, well, treatment center, what do you treat? And they said, well, we work with people with drug and alcohol problems. And I thought, well, that's fascinating. And you know, I didn't lock eyes with them the rest of the visit there. Tell me more. I called him up later that day, and I, you know, I wrote these commercials, and I called him up later that day, and I said, okay, this is what I got. This is a, I feel helpless, and I feel hopeless, and my wife divorced me. I can't keep a job, and I can't stop drinking. And she said, that's perfect. And somebody said, well, why don't you record that? And so I did. I'd never done any really recording. I have these voice undulations, as you can tell. But so I'm driving down the street, and I'd been overcompensating for my blacking out and passing out for about a week. And I drive down into Yuma Valley, and my voice comes out over Yuma, and it says, I feel helpless, and I feel hopeless, and my wife divorced me, and I can't keep a job, and I can't stop drinking. And I went, oh, now everybody knows. Oh, my God, I'll tell you, you can't make this stuff up. I mean, this is real-life stuff. And so, you know, the general manager called me in, and he said, look, you're an embarrassment to the radio station. We feel like, you know, and they knew the tip of the iceberg. They didn't know all the other insanity stuff. I mean, I am totally whacked, and I'm just waiting any time to get thrown into jail. You know what I mean? So he calls up, and he says, come on in. You know, we've had enough of your little game. And I was crushed. And what happened was I said, well, you know, do I have insurance? And he said, yes. And I said, well, I just put this treatment facility on the air. Can I go in there and get a little treatment? And he said, well, yeah, of course. So oddly enough, I found a home in this. I found a bed in this little treatment facility in 1987. And you know, I'm in there strutting around. You know, I put you guys on the news, and, you know, I was the one that wrote the commercials, and they'd say things like, oh, just make your bed and come to group, Jeff. And Wow. So the miracle or the magic of Alcoholics Anonymous happened for me in that little treatment facility in 1987. And a guy came in on it was a Saturday night, and I believe it was St. Patrick's Day, which was a big drinking day for me. And he came in, and he brought the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he came in by himself, and he, you know, that didn't register to me. But he said, usually I come in with a partner, but my partner couldn't make it tonight. So he came in, and I don't know what would have happened if he wouldn't have come in there, because that was my opportunity. And sometimes when we're new, the opportunity for us to hear about sobriety or Alcoholics Anonymous is a very slender thread. And he came in and talked about what it was like, what happened, and what he's like, trying to be like today. And I read how it works from the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous for the first time in my life. And this guy told a story, and I absolutely knew there was nobody else on the face of the earth that knew how I drank, that knew how I thought, or certainly didn't know how I felt. And this guy had me in all three areas. He drank exactly the way I did. He was absolutely insane. You know, he was able to communicate that story to me. And then, you know, the feelings of just never fitting and the feelings of, you know, just kind of, he described the spiritual malady in a way that I can't even remember. But I know it touched me. You know, he had me that night. And so what happened? You know, I know a lot of four-letter words, but help wasn't one of them. You know, I don't know how to do this thing. You know, I'm just absolutely dying on the inside, but I can't say, help. How do you do this thing? He talked about going to meetings and getting involved and all that stuff. But I'll tell you, it was remote for me. So I was released after 10 days of treatment. I got released, and my girlfriend picked me up, and we went out to Chinese dinner. And I ordered Pepsi, and we're sitting around, and you know, I had problems other than alcohol. And she said, usually get Budweiser. I said, well, I just spent 10 days in this little treatment facility, and I have a pretty good idea I shouldn't drink. And she said, beer's never been a problem for you. And I said, you're right. You know, beer has never been a problem, you know, for me. I mean, because I can drink a gallon of this stuff, you know. What could one beer hurt, you know? And just like Jim and the car salesman in the book, I had a beer. And I went, no major things going on here. Give me another one, you know. And boom, I had another beer and another beer. And, you know, in no time at all, I was absolutely helpless and hopeless one more time. I'd moved back to San Diego, And the notion of going to an AA meeting, that fleeting thought was just gone. You know, going to another meeting, it was gone somewhere. I don't know where it was at. But I came back to San Diego and got arrested a couple of times. I don't arrest well. I don't jail well. You know, I don't want to be a trustee or any of that stuff. That wasn't my goal in life, to be a jail trustee. But that's the path I was going on. I guess I'd have taken it if they'd offered it. I think you get more food or something. I do you more? More is going, yeah, they give you more stuff. So, you know, it was gone. You know, back in 1990, you know, I was living up by Lake Murray on the North Shore. There's no houses there, but I was kind of living over there. And then I had some acquaintances in Lakeside, and I'd kind of sleep at their house for a few days. And then, you know, I'd go back to my dad's house and shower up and have a meal, and then I'd go back out to explore the edge of the earth. And I didn't know that I was homeless till I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. You guys put a nice tidy bow on that. And so I came back, and I was completely beaten. I was completely beaten. It was all gone. I hadn't seen my daughter in over 4 years. I had a relationship with, I had a son somewhere along the line, and I pushed him away when he was infant, and I didn't want to claim any responsibility for that son. And, you know, the guilt and the shame and the remorse of that doesn't go away. In fact, you can drink, and you can drink a lot, and it just, as soon as you're undrunk, it just pops back up, and it's right here on your face. You know, the shame of not seeing my daughter, and I would wonder what happened, you know. What happened? I mean, this isn't the kid that my parents raised. This is, you know, everything, I did everything out there almost imaginable to destroy my life, and in doing so, also the lives of the people around me. So, you know, when I came back, all of a sudden, I'm, you know, living in my dad's house, and I'm watching TV, and they were doing some 12-step work on TV, you know, back then, and there was a show on there, it was called the Dead Poets Society, and they talked about Carpe Diem, seize the day. And then all of a sudden, it popped back into my mind about going to meetings, and it was like, seize the day. And it was like this little epiphany, just like, you better get your ass up and go to a meeting because you're dying. You know, and I know what it feels like to be dying. You know, I'd already given all my stuff away to my friends. I don't know if anybody here ever did that, but you know you're not going to be around. You just give all your little artwork away because to the people you like, because you know you're not going to live much longer. And so I came back to you in 1990, and my sobriety date is December 25th, 1990, and I hope and pray that I'm always willing to do whatever it takes here in Alcoholics Anonymous to maintain that sobriety. You know, there's kind of a secret oath here that I believe each one of us makes that comes to Alcoholics Anonymous and stays. You know, and they read it at every meeting, just about every meeting, when they read how it works. If you want what we have and you're willing to go to any lengths to do it, or give yourself completely to this simple program. And usually this solemn oath, we start to detect it when we see you in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, because we come in, and it's like to the Travises and the Bills and guys like that that just start showing up at meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And when they're asking for commitments, their hand goes up. And then they do the action that it takes to stay around here. And somewhere along the line, I made that secret oath that I decided I wanted what you guys have. And I was just so absolutely miserable with what I had. It was like the last shot. It's either going to try Alcoholics Anonymous and give myself completely to the simple program or not. I don't know what else to do. And the loving arms of Alcoholics Anonymous were thrown around me. And people started calling me, you know, come on, kid. And let's go to this meeting. Let's go to that meeting. Let's get busy and doing the things we do in Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I didn't say that right when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. There was a period of time there where I was just going to meetings, and I hadn't really taken the steps yet, and I hadn't really made any commitments to Alcoholics Anonymous. And what that is called is untreated alcoholism. And you can be absolutely insane and be physically sober in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous and be goofier than you were out there. And that's what I had. I was just whacked. And somewhere along the line, people talked about going to meetings and taking the steps and all that stuff. And so I was a slow learner here in Alcoholics Anonymous. But at some point in time, I surrendered, like I believe that we all surrender if we stay around here. Surrender to Alcoholics Anonymous is a new way of life, a design for living that works. It actually works better when things are really going bad. And, yeah, I have experience with that. I started doing that, and I started to feel like I was part of this thing. I found a sponsor, Barney Morris. He's gone to the big meeting, and he didn't care how I felt. He didn't care how I felt, or he really cared less about what I thought. He was not above telling me, giving me directions in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he got me involved in a home group and all these things, and I started taking the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. At 6 months of sobriety, I was reunited with my little girl, Sarah, and she'd gone from being a little girl into a young woman. And, I missed a lot of that. I tried being a father for a while, but I just was a miserable failure. But I got to see my daughter, Sarah, again, and I got to bring her 2 dozen yellow roses and say, I don't know how it's just going to be different. It's going to get better. So we've been rekindling this relationship now for a while. So I went to work for this little coffee company, and they turned out to be a big coffee company after a while. And at some point in time there, I worked in the shipyard, and I'd taken the steps, and I started feeling better, and I went to work for this coffee company. I just tried to practice Alcoholics Anonymous in the workplace. You show up, you do what you're supposed to do. You don't take their stuff. It took a while to learn that. I got priors, but so they started saying, well, we'd like you to move to Northern California, right? So I said, wow, Northern California. And just for that, I said, yeah. I went to my sponsor and his sponsor, and they said, yeah, you don't have much going on here. Go north. So I went to the Lemon Grove Alana Club, and my beautiful bride was there, Anita. And I'd seen her name on H&I documents. She was very active in that. We kind of locked eyes a little bit, and you know how they really check you out, you know. But anyhow, we decided that we had a lot of things in common, so we're going to date for a little while. And so we dated for about a month or two, and then she helped move me to Northern California. And then a short time after that, about a year later, she moved up, and she brought her sons, the Menendez boys, with her. Well, they're 6'3 and 6'4, and they got priors. And then I heard her story, like you heard last week, and I thought, geez, I got Ma Barker and the Menendez boys. But we've had a fantastic time, and she's an inspiration to me. How she ceaselessly works this program with other women, and our relationship was founded on Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's sustained by our actions in Alcoholics Anonymous, and we both love it. And we got busy up in Northern California, and we ended up buying a condominium up there. The boys, our youngest boy, Jeremy, is sober 8.5 years now in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And our other son, Jacob, he's doing really well. He went through an apprenticeship on the low voltage side of the electrical thing, and they liked him so much at the union, they're having him go back and become a full electrician. So he's got nothing but great things to look forward to. And I believe it's a direct result of Anita being sober and perhaps me being a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And as soon as I stopped treating those boys like stepchildren, we all started to behave a little better. And in certain ways, I'm so grateful to have those boys in my life, because I was such a failure as a father and a human being. To have the opportunity to just see these kids start to grow and blossom is something you can't buy. It's an amazing thing. Just before that, too, my son Ryan came back in my life. He was about 15 when we started seeing our son Ryan, and he was a little pissed at Dad. He was really pissed for a while. And we'd get together and do some stuff, and then he'd drop off the radar for 6 years or 8 years or whatever. And today was his birthday, and we just went up and had birthday lunch with our son Ryan and his brother. And he's bringing his brother along now because he wants his brother to get to know his real dad. and we had the grandkids there. And through the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, we're building this beautiful relationship. And God, I love the kid, you know, and he's a lot like me. I mean, he's got an abnormal reaction to alcohol, so we're not going to go there. So Anita and I started getting very active up in Northern California, doing a lot of things, doing a lot of stuff up there, and we just loved it. And we ended up selling the place in Pacifica and moved over to the East Bay and got very active in the East Bay and San Francisco and all over the darn place up there. Our life is founded on Alcoholics Anonymous and participation in Alcoholics Anonymous. We love the life that it's been given to us. So some things started to happen, and, you know, I went to work for that company and, you know, just had a meteoric career working there. And all I really ever did was practice Alcoholics Anonymous. And I show up and I do the things they'd asked me to do. And, you know, there's a spark of creativity that comes along with being sober for a while. And I got to be creative and I got to do some things like that. And you know, I was pushed up into a senior project manager position, the first one in the Western United States. Received a lot of awards and stuff. And every time they'd serve you up an award, I always want to say, well, you know, I actually owe this to the grace of God and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. But in corporate America, you just say thank you. And, but that's true. Any success I have is a direct result of being involved with Alcoholics Anonymous. And made a lot of money doing that. And, you know, things got a little dicey, and we had the opportunity to move back to San Diego. I told Anita, I said, why don't you come home, baby? Let's go back to San Diego. We'll buy the family house, which we did. Buy the house, and she's going to retire, and I'm going to take care of you, little girl. And, you know, let you watch soap operas every day and all that stuff. And so we're doing that, and I went to work for the same company as a consultant, and I'm doing a lot of high-end hotel chains and things like that. Just having, you know, just one of these jobs that, God, it was just a dream come true type job. Well, finally, you know, the bottom fell out of that, and I was released from this company on February 13th, Friday the 13th of all days, yeah. And so on the 19th, we had a little retirement party over at my daughter Sarah's house. And I'd been to the doctor that morning, right, and had all the blood check stuff done and all that. And we had this little retirement party, and we're, you know, I'm going to get a job at the golf course and do all this stuff. And then actually, 11 months ago today, I think Jewel J was the speaker here. And I came here for that meeting that night. Wasn't feeling all that good, right? And that was February 21st. And I went home that night, and after I heard Jewel's great talk, and had a stroke in my sleep. Yeah. And I woke up, and half my vision was gone. And I threw some water on my face, and I looked out the window. I went, shit, half the yard's gone. And then threw some more water on my face, and I went down, and half of Anita was gone. And I said, this is not good. And so off we went to the hospital. I spent the next 4 days in the hospital with a stroke, and it mostly just affected the vision. And, you know, I tell you, I was a little pissed there for a little while. It's like, man, you know, don't you understand if there is something up there that we just had a retirement party like 2 days ago, and the doctor said I was in okay shape. And here I am flat on my back with, you know, tubes and arrows and all that stuff. Just wondering if we're going to make it. You know, afraid to go to sleep because I didn't want another wake-up surprise. But, you know, members of Alcoholics Anonymous started showing up. My friend Steve back there and some other people started showing up. Tom and John and his wife showed up at the hospital. And, you know, somewhere along the line, and, you know, you don't want to get mad when you're doing that, but I just felt like this is really disappointing, you know. How can you work all your life and lose half your vision in one night and just continue on? But the things that Alcoholics Anonymous has taught me was I'd get up and I'd start walking around the aisles, around the hospital wing, and I'd start to see people that were really devastated by a stroke. I said, well, you know, I guess I still have my motor skills. I started doing those things. And people in Alcoholics Anonymous, I had a couple of brand new sponsees I was working with. And maybe I could go to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous as soon as I get out of here. So that's been my journey here in AA, is just come out and be with you guys. And I'm as active today as I've ever been in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I love it. You know, 2 days out of the hospital, I was golfing. First day out of the hospital, I was in a meeting of Alcoholics. Now I was golfing wildly, by the way. You don't want to stand on the left. So it's like, oh, sorry. And You don't want to, like, walk right up to me on the left-hand side because I won't see you there. But, you know, much like the disease of alcoholism, is once I surrendered to the reality that I'm absolutely helpless and hopeless, barring some kind of spiritual relief, things started to get better. You know, and about 5 months into the struggle, well, Anita and I, we decided to go on vacation. She was just fabulous. I mean, she's taken me to meetings and taking me golfing. And I mean, I wasn't driving or nothing, you know. And other people of Alcoholics Anonymous would show up and take me here and take me there. And, you know, I just was absolutely astonished at how much support and love is out there. So at 3 months of sobriety, we found ourselves in Utah doing some AA stuff out there. And then Anita, we jumped out of an airplane together. And that's a trip, you know, really, 10,000 feet above the desert floor in Moab, Utah. Now, I don't think my cardiologist would have co-signed this, but it seemed like the spiritual thing to do at the time. But it sure took my fear of heights away, I'll tell you that. And we started getting busy around the house, and we'd been doing the stuff, and, you know, we just rebuilt our home, and, you know, been surrounded by members of Alcoholics Anonymous. Two of the most magnificent things I've seen this year as a direct result of being involved in Alcoholics Anonymous was I got to see Travis and John W. have a spiritual awakening as a direct result of taking the program of action. Now, you can't buy that. Now, if you're new to Alcoholics Anonymous and you think that's remote, stick around. Do the things we do. You get to watch people change right in front of your very eyes. You get to witness yourself change. Usually people see the change in you before you do yourself. They go, wow, look, he or she is showing up at meetings of alcohol. They're doing this deal. You know, they're actively involved in this thing. And I just absolutely love Alcoholics Anonymous. I had the great privilege a few years ago of walking my little daughter Sarah down the aisle. And, you know, that should have been gone. By all rights, that should have been gone. I should have never had the opportunity to do that. She asked me to walk her down the aisle, and we danced with tears in her eyes, and there was 135 people in the room that night that saw us dancing, and they all had tears in their eyes. And they just knew the tip of the iceberg. You know, they didn't know all the other stuff. They didn't know that I hadn't seen my daughter for 4 years. And, you know, she loves me today, absolutely loves me, and I absolutely love her. We have these two grandchildren with us tonight. You know, and heaven help, I just hope this never happens, but if anything was to happen to my daughter and her husband, we would be the guardians of the children. And, you know, I'm the guy living at Lake Murray and walking down the street, and mothers pull their kids to the other side of the street when they see you coming. You know, that's what came to you guys 19 plus years ago. You know, we're living the dream, man. I have never had it so good. Recently, just very recently, I was released to start driving again. So that's a warning to you. if you see my truck coming out, I get to drive in daylight hours now, and it's kind of cool. You know, there's some things you got to do. But, man, just to be able to go to meetings and just to be able to go and hang out and do this thing, you don't know what you lost till it's gone sometimes. But the thing that has kept me here in Alcoholics Anonymous is the hope in your eyes. When I go to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous and I see our friend Maura, I know she shouldn't be sober, but she's sober and she lives a good life and she's got a wonderful husband, Harry, and they're both very active members of Alcoholics Anonymous. When I see other people come in here, Bob's been around AA. God, there's so many people in here that have taken Alcoholics Anonymous as a way of life. And I've seen people overcome astonishing tragedies, and they just keep putting one foot in front of the other. So, you know, there is no excuse for an alcoholic of my variety. Now that I'm sober and Alcoholics Anonymous, there is a solution. There is a solution. And, you know, I'm sober by the grace of God, a loving God that I found here in Alcoholics Anonymous. And certainly the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and the actions we take in Alcoholics Anonymous. So how can I say thank you for the life that you've given me? How can I say thank you for my children and my grandchildren that when they call now, they know mom and dad's at home and that we're willing to do whatever it takes. I tell you, the only way I know how to say thank you is to give my life completely to you. So I want to thank you very much for the life you've given me.